What's up, everybody? Welcome to The Stack. I'm Alex.
I'm Justin.
And on The Stack, we talk about a ton of books that are coming out this week. So let's kick it off with some big ones. DC versus Vampires, World War V, number one.
Are these guys going to lose? Oh, man. Vampires.
I watched World War I and World War II, but I missed World War III and World War IV. So we're up to World War V, Roman numerals.
Shit, I will say World War III was crazy.
But fun. But a fun war.
Yeah, it was a much more personal war. I fought it at home with my family.
Fighting with my family.
My wife and I versus the kids.
Nice. Written by Matthew Rosenberg, art by Otto Schmidt. This is a sequel to the previous DC versus Vampires stories. Here we're picking up with Barbara Gordon, is now the queen of the vampires, entered an uneasy detente with the humans. And meanwhile, Damian Wayne, also a vampire, is mucking things up on the side. This is also under the Elseworlds imprint. So before you think that the blood hunt has begun again, this is not like that. This is not in continuity. This is out of continuity, its own continuity. And frankly, I think it is all the better for that because it can actually take chances on the story.
Well, I mean, I don't know. Did you feel like the previous DC versus Vampires didn't take chances? I thought it was one of the more chances.
Yeah, for sure. I'm comparing this specifically to like Blood Hunt ended 2 weeks ago, last week, something like that.
I think Blood Hunt is what actually caused Joe Biden to drop out of the presidential race. It was about 3 weeks ago. Yeah.
Okay. He was like, I can't deal with these daywalkers.
I've been hunting blood too. I'm Varney, he said.
Yep. Anyway, this is great. Good danger here. Great emotion with Green Arrow and Black Canary. Otto Schmidt's art is fantastic. The action scenes are great. I love this book. It's
The art is fantastic. It is interesting how it's more complicated than the original series, where it's like, so there are vampires, then there are other vampires, then there are humans, and whose side is right? We don't know. Really? You thought you liked Robin, but do you? These humans seem nice, but are they? Barbara Gordon seems mean, but she's nice generally. Mm-hmm. What do we do?
But also, this is a title with a vampire super monkey, so I feel like it's basically a perfect comic at that point.
Well, and I will say I do like the tone where they're sort of like, it's serious. It's like a world ruined. The opening sequence kills, mild spoiler, some characters you like usually. So that's sad. But they're still having some fun. We're having some fun with talking shit to Grodd.
Yeah, I guess what I mean by comparing this to Blood Hunt, though, is Blood Hunt is part of an ongoing continuity, so they can really only change so much for so long and only kill people, turn them. Like, Miles Morales is still a vampire, but he's not going to be.
In some ways, he is, unless you read any of the comics we have in this current stack. And then he's regular old Miles.
Sure is. But here, at least, because it's his own thing, they can do what they want. And I'm not even just talking about character deaths. I'm talking about like the emotional journeys of the characters. They can push them in different ways. And Matthew Rosenberg is an expert at that. So
good. Definitely. It's a great book. It is funny that to pick this up after Blood Hunt, they're like, yeah, it's night all the time here. And I'm like, I know. I've lived this. I feel like everything is night.
Blood Hunt. Yeah. Let's turn to a non-Blood Hunt and more to a Turtle Hunt, the opposite of a Blood Hunt, with Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles Night Watcher number one from IDW, written by Judy Ba, art by Pharaoh Pei. This is two things kind of going on, I would suggest. One is there's an overall mystery about the identity of Night Watcher. And then the other thing is the city, and very specifically Mutant Town, which is a town of mutant characters like
something
TMNT.
We talked about on last week's podcast.
Exactly. All reacting to this vigilante who's kind of like Batman meets Iron Man sort of thing and how they feel about it. Tell you what, I was pretty down on Mutant Town. I was down to clown on Mutant Town, if you will. This sold me on it. I think Judy Ba did a great job of fleshing it out and comparing it to prejudice in the real world and making it relevant and interesting here. the identity of Night Watcher almost becomes second to the comic book in a certain way, which I thought was very interesting.
Well, and like there's an inevitability to the reveal that we do get at the end of this issue, which I was excited about. And I was the one who was very pro Mutant Town on the podcast. And I think my belief has been borne out by this comic. This was fun. It feels like it has a point of view. And it's sort of what we were talking about with Mutant Town. I think you and Pete were sort of like, it feels just sort of like a whatever place that is adjacent to the main Turtles title and what's happening there. And this issue really defined it in a way that I thought was really important and made for just a great starting point to explore Mutant Town the way we explore downtown Manhattan.
Right. And you're talking about the financial district, how we're always walking around being like, oh, man, there's that big bull.
And I'm always wandering around in a mask beating the shit out of Fidei dudes. You know what I mean?
I go directly to the stock floor. I find Glenn Powell and I hold him down. And you don't know it's Glenn Powell yet because he's not famous. But I hold him down and I'm like, this money here is not yours. Things like that.
Wow. Yeah. Nice. Classic. That really teaches. It's crazy. Glenn Powell still goes to the stock exchange floor every day.
And he's like, huh? That Twister.
He's fun. He's fun. He's the last movie star, just so you know. He's the last movie star.
R.I.P. movie stars. X-Factor number one from Marvel, written by Mark Russell, art by Bob Quinn. As you might expect from the creative team behind this, this is a satirical book, very much in the mode of Ecstatics, the Peter Milligan, Mike Allred book. This poking fun at fame through the lens of X-Men. But I'll tell you what. I always like Mark Russell. I'm always a big fan of his. Fun, satirical, social media stuff through this book. His Angel is putting together a team. It's a goofy team. They're not particularly good. The last couple of pages, though, are such a like grim gut punch about the cyclical nature of comic books. I was like, I cannot believe Marvel printed this. Honestly.
I agree, and that's what you want, though, from a Mark Russell book. And it's also sort of, I feel like some of our recent X-Force / Ecstatics takes have been blunted versions of the, like, yeah, what if mutants were famous? What, they'd be on their phones all the time. And this has the dark edge that I think the original Ecstatics premise was built around, and I guess X-Force came first. And I thought it was a great version of that. It still has the fun, lighter comedy moments with the dark underbelly. This is, if you're a fan of watching esoteric, especially late 90s mutants get wrecked, I would definitely pick this book up, because I feel like every issue is going to be like, oh yeah, you liked Cecilia Reyes? Well, she's probably going to get murked or something here.
I think, is it okay to jump in and kind of spoil it a little bit? Because I think just to talk about it.
You're the spoiler on the podcast. I am. So do you?
People comment about it. But most of the book is that thing that I think you're talking about, where it's like, they're on their phones. They're trending on social media. Isn't this cool? This is funny. It's fine. It does a fine job. And I was like, all right, I'm a little muted by this because we've seen this a lot already, this sort of parody. But towards the end of the issue, almost everybody on the team dies. The guy who is running the team is like, you know what I realized actually is nobody cares about the members of the group. They just want to follow the plot. And it is such an indictment of how people read and talk about X-Men comics in particular. It's wild.
Well, and last episode of The Stack, I talked a lot about how I have such fatigue of the philosophizing of reboots, where every team is like, here's how we're different. And they're in a void just talking about how they're different. It's like, yeah, I know you're talking about it because you're a new writer defining him or herself in relation to this X title. But this sort of took that idea and was like, fuck that, though. Yeah. And was like, there's no philosophy here. Let's just throw more meat into the grinder and see who gets squeezed.
Yeah. And I'll just mention the last panel, which shows the new team that shows up after most of this team is dead, led by Havoc. there's one surviving member who is a new guy named Cyber. And the way that Bob Quinn draws him at the end, being like, yeah.
Yes, so funny.
Oh, my God. Favorite well, and panel I will say, of the week, baby?
It was I agree. And I also loved Pyros in the end. And there was another fire-based character who gets wrecked. And I was like, bro, did you read the news yesterday about how the other you got ruined?
Well, and I love the fact also, just to keep complimenting this book, but when the cover popped up, I was like, Jesus Christ, that's a lot of white blonde dudes. What are we doing here? That's the point of the book.
Exactly. I was going to say, we did literally talk about that very thing. Like, it is about the interchangeability of, especially like, again, this is a spoiler, but we're exchanging Angel and Havoc, where it's like, put those guys in a lineup and tell we've no wings show. Tell me the difference between those dudes. So I appreciate that. And I want to shout out Bob Quinn's art, an artist that I haven't really followed a ton. But man, the characters are all so expressive. The action's really fun and very like legit superhero action while retaining the sort of comedic premise. Mm-hmm. It reminded me of like great classic like New Warriors tone to the art, and it's really nice to see.
Good stuff. Let's move on to another great book, not to spoil the review here, but Houses of the Unholy from Image Comics, written by Ed Brubaker, art by Sean Phillips. You know what you're getting into at this point with this pair. But we talked to Ed about this back on the show months ago. It came on on December. Great episode. Definitely listen to it on the live show. But where I believe we broke the news about this book, actually.
We did.
So there you go.
He announced it there.
Even with what he told us about the book, I was not expecting the plot here, which weaves between the satanic panic of the 80s and 90s and the repercussions today and how, in particular, they affect one character. Justin, you were mentioning on the live show you were a big fan of this, so talk about this book.
I mean, obviously, this creative team are just masters of making comics. So anything they do is worth the read. But I, just to highlight what is special about this book, Satanic Panic is something that I think so many people in our culture are using as their creative springboard. Stranger Things. Mm-hmm. Like, it's such a fad to be like, it's like Satanic Panic, but... And what I want to credit this book with is they take the Satanic Panic and actually draw a line to what it is now. And I don't think everyone's actually sort of using Satanic Panic as a whole meal the way they do here. They're just sort of referencing it and moving on as like, yeah, these people were just nerds trying to live. And this is actually like, well, wait, they're actually that feeling and that way of reacting to things became something else. And it's something far more insidious now that is affecting people at a lot of different levels. And I don't want to spoil anything, but this book really explores that from a couple different sides. There's some great twists and turns. As always, just great main character, great characters making bad choices, very sort of real people that you don't know but still think exist in the world. And that's awesome.
It's also... I don't know. This is obvious, given that they are masters of the form, like you said, but... It's so different from Where the Body Was. Where the Body was a book that, for anybody who didn't read it, a body is left on a cul-de-sac and we slowly explore the characters who live there. But it's also the most romantic and one of the more hopeful books that the pair has done. This is not. This is very much the opposite of it. It's nihilistic. It's sad. It is an indictment, like you're saying, of...
Doomed from the start, I would argue.
100%. It's an indictment of online culture and its extension off of, you know, what used to be online, just the phone chain or the newspapers, the magazines, TV stations, anything like that. And that's what they're drawing here. So there's a lot on their minds. And I almost think... This is not denigrating those things, but Where the Body Was and Houses the Unholy, I think, are such a step up in a certain way from Criminal, even, where Criminal was talking about a lot of stuff all the time. You know, they had that whole arc that was about the comic book industry. They had arcs about other things. But ultimately, that was like noir, gritty crime thriller. These essentially one-and-done graphic novels are giving them such a sense of focus and such a chance to play around with different tones and different ideas. They're really bringing it to a new level.
Well, and evolving that sort of type of comic book storytelling, using the character development from a noir and putting it on different things, like Where the Body Was is like a mystery where we're seeing sort of all access points to it. And it's very much a character study about people in the daily suburban wasteland. This very different from that, following the way that the things early on in our life sort of scar our lives in different ways. I would say positive and negative, but it's mostly negative.
Yeah,
in this
pretty
book.
Much.
But like it's elevating noir to something different. And that's really cool. Comic book.
I didn't write this down in the credits, but I want to give a shout out to Jacob Phillips' colors in this in particular. This vacillates between the main sections, which are generally colored, and flashback sections, which are almost entirely colored in red and black. And it provides such a counterpoint that I don't want to say how it plays out through the book, but it plays out in a story way in the book as well. So smartly done. This is just, at this point, you should have pre-ordered it. You should pick up these things up no matter what.
We just scold you about this book.
Yeah, how dare
like,
you?
It's not like pick how it up. It's how come you haven't? It should be in your hand already. Yeah. Psychopaths.
Let's talk about another book that I was really pleasantly surprised by. Babs, yeah. Number one from Ahoy Comics, written by Garth Ennis, art by Jason Burroughs. On the cover alone, don't judge a book by the cover, but it looks like, oh, okay, they're doing a Red Sonja parody. That's pretty much what they're going to do here. And that's kind of how it starts out with a barbarian woman who's wearing a chainmail bikini, riding a horse through the woods, and she's talking about how it's chafing her, and she's cursing a lot.
This goddamn scale mail is going to chew my fucking nipples off.
Yep. And you're like, okay, that's what I expected from this book. There's also, I will mention, a very funny series of battles of a fox jumping and trying to catch a rabbit and then missing the rabbit and bonking its head on a log. And I was like, great, this is them doing Mad Magazine. Cool, let's get into it. That is not what this is. I mean, that's kind of what this is, but it's not actually that. It's actually, once again, an indictment of comic book fans, and particularly how trolls engage with gender flipping or changing the race of characters. Great. Like, I love that they Trojan horsed in screw you trolls, I hope you die, in the middle of this thing of like, hey, check out this sexy lady. Gotcha.
Yeah. And I want to, of course, the creative team is excellent. Garth Ennis writing, Jason Burroughs on the art, really great. Very much using the sort of Red Sonja style and telling this, like, very irreverent, funny, but still action-y story. But, like, I want to shout out Ahoy Comics for just, like, really carving out their hole here in the market and being like, no, they bring in great creatives. Mark Russell has worked with them a ton. And like, that tone really, like, it's just a great space for them to be in. And I really like that I hope this book does really well because it's really great. And it should be what they're doing. No one else is doing this.
I also think it really points to, and maybe, I don't know, I've had this sort of bouncing around in the back of my head for a while. I feel like we should almost do a reassessment of Garth Ennis episode of the show, just based on The Boys in particular, because there's been such an online conversation about that book doesn't hold up, the comic book isn't good. I haven't read it since we originally read it and reviewed it on the show, but one of two things have happened, and I don't know the answer to this because I haven't looked back on it. Either Garth Ennis has evolved exponentially as the comic book industry has evolved and responded to it with books like Babs, with his other comic books that are like not as bratty as you think they are and are actually very often smart and poignant and pointed at things in society in a way that makes sense. Or alternately, he was always like that, and we just kind of missed it years ago with things like The Boys. So I don't know. I think, like, at the very least, Garth Ennis has broken away from – he was sort of lumped in with, like, Mark Millar in particular. Yeah. And he's broken up with Mark Millar's like, I'm a child, and I continue to be a child. And Garth Ennis is like, hold up. I can still do childish things and do profane things and have talk about my nipples chafing and have a fox buck on a log and all this. There's one point where Babs reaches down a literal troll's throat and makes him vomit nonstop. Barf, it's gross. It's funny. But it's in the middle of all this stuff that is very pointed about, like, you guys are acting this like this online, and that is actively bad.
Well, but I also think I agree with the reassessment of Garth Ennis, because I think we were like, this guy is violence. His violence is so crazy. But he's always been sort of wickedly funny at the same time. And I feel like this book is like, hey, remember, I'm also the funny one. That's why The Boys is such a phenomenon, is not just it's the heightened violence, but the heightened comedy and satire. That's why The Show is such a hit. And this book is doing that, but just not as violent, not as over the top violence. That's not the joke here. The joke is something else, what we're talking about. And that's what he's always been doing. It's just one took precedent over the other.
Yep. Great stuff. Definitely check out this book.
Have you seen Chuck Norris lately? He's still kicking butt and staying active well into his 80s. What's even more shocking is he looks more jacked than ever and seems to have more energy than guys half his age. And it's all thanks to Morning Kick, a revolutionary new daily drink from Roundhouse Provisions that combines ultra-potent greens like spirulina and kale with probiotics, prebiotics, collagen, and even ashwagandha. Just mix with water, stir, and enjoy. Unlike other green drinks out there, this one tastes exactly like strawberry lemonade and has hundreds of 5-star reviews. Go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 for up to 44% off your regular priced order. Plus, every purchase is backed by a 90-day money-back guarantee. So if you want to experience smoother digestion, a boost of energy, and just an overall healthier body, then go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 today. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Results can vary.
Absolute Power Task Force 7, number 4, from DC Comics, are written by Pornsack Pichichot, art by Claire Rowe. As usual with this title, it is focusing on one of the Amazo robots, except in this case, it's actually Failsafe, the evil robot Batman, who's taking on the remains of the Bat family in the Court of Owls maze. So lots of stuff going on here. I thought this was a great issue of this title that continues to punch really above its weight. This is, I don't know, between this and Absolute Power Origins, just the spin-offs that they are doing for this event are so good and so essential, because they're making sure to like layer little pieces of additional information about the mysteries of the overall event. I was really blown away by this one.
I just feel like the title is doing a disservice to this book, the Task Force 7. Sure. Get rid of that. This needs to be Absolute Power, what's actually happening in this crossover, number 4. Because, like, this is what the stories are. And, like, that's not a knock against the main title. The main title is great, but that's, like, the, you know, widescreen IMAX version of this event. But this is the story. This is so essential to the read here. It's so good. This book gives so much clarity of what the actual things that are happening are. And I just think this is essential reading to a crossover that I'm really enjoying. The heat check on Absolute Power is, this is really good. It's really thoughtful. It felt like coming in, this was going to be like an Amanda Waller just naked, like, she wins so hard and then the heroes come back and win so hard. But in fact, there's actually a lot of interesting ideas at play here undergirding it. And I support all of the choices that are being made in the main title and especially this title.
Well, and this one is particularly smart because it dives into the entire Bat family, very specifically Dick Grayson and Damian Wayne and Tim Drake, right? Like
Tim Drake. Yeah.
Tim Drake. Sorry. So it shows off them as well as a couple of other characters, but throwing them in the maze the Court of Owls have from one of the most seminal Batman books that Scott Snyder and Greg Capullo created, it amps up the level of danger for them and draws a line of like, they're probably not going to win here. They can't win against Failsafe. This is the worst place for the Bat family to be as well. So it puts them in the on their back legs. And spoiler here, but like that's where they end up at the end. Like they do not win at the end here. They just kind of pull out a draw at best.
And I especially like they include two other heroes here, the Ray Terrell and Miss Martian. And they're, I'm like, oh, these people are here to die or something. Mm-hmm. Because you're like, why else would you include them? They're depowered. So they're just like, what do I even do here? And then it plays out in a way where I'm like, oh my God, I'm so scared for these characters. We also see Voodoo from Wildcats who's here. And I'm like, mm-hmm. She's definitely dying. And it just doesn't go that way. The way the story unfolds, and it created so much tension for me to have these almost red shirt characters be there, and it made me root for them so hard. It's just really smartly done, and we're talking about sort of comics that are reacting to comics, and this one is subverting our expectations of what an event is in a really smart way.
Yeah. Guys, we really love comics, and I'm going to continue to love comics with The Ultimates number 3 from Marvel, written by Dennis Kemp, art by Juan Fragueri. I know we're going kind of over the moon here, but oh my God, this
stressful
book.
Comic. Yes. Stress read from this little doggy.
Yeah, this is fascinating to me. And the reason this is fascinating to me, this issue gives us a new origin for the Hulk, kind of. We actually don't find out too much about Bruce Banner other than he used the gamma bomb near an island in, I want to say, the Philippines or something like that. It's not 100%.
It says the Pacific. The Pacific Proving Grounds.
Yes. So it's dealing with atomic testing and the fallout from that. It falls out on an island. I will spoil this here, but the Ultimates go because they think, okay, we're going to find somebody here who can fight the Hulk, who is the strongest of the characters who works for the Baker, the evil Reed Richards, who is eventually going to emerge. They need to stop him before they take on the Maker. And they do end up meeting a version of She-Hulk here. But what we discover is a bunch of other horrific characters who have been hurt by this atomic testing. What was really underlined for me this issue, that was already very much teased in the second issue, maybe a little less in the first issue, is the way that the original Ultimates was about pro-government, over-the-top parody, we're the winners, we're the like authority, but in the Marvel Universe, this is about the underdogs. This is about how the government has failed the people. Last issue, we got a guy who literally bought the White House and hid I think America Chavez is Latina. I apologize if I got that wrong, but hid somebody from an underserved community at the bottom of the White House and held her prisoner. Here we're getting Pacific Islanders who have been affected by atomic testing, and all they want is the chance to live their life on their islands. Like, this is political commentary in superhero comics at its finest.
It's Dennis Kemp. Someone who, on a writer that I love, that goes hard all the time and touches real issues. And to your point, if this is like the anti-Ultimates, the Mark Millar version of it, it's like, hey, the way it worked with the Maker ruining everything was like an authoritarian state is created. So the only way to defeat that is through the people. And so it's about finding ways to activate people who have been devastated by the government and use that to form this team of Ultimates to then take on the Maker. And as we are teased every issue, the months are counting down. At the end of this issue, there are 15 months left. So you have a ticking clock. Their stakes are high. This is a stress read in a good way. And honestly, it makes you really hate the Hulk, and it makes you really like Bruce Banner's an enemy here.
Yeah, I kind of love that as a theory, just kind of looking ahead 15 months at this point. If the whole plot line is Iron Lad trying to reactivate heroes and create heroes in the Ultimate Universe, but the ultimate takeaway, like no pun intended, but the ultimate takeaway here being No, it's not the heroes. It's the people who need to fight back. That's awesome if they end up at that place.
Well, and just the fact, this issue alone, where it's like, hey, we're going to go to this island and find like a cool She-Hulk. And they're like, oh, it's a devastating situation that we didn't know one's handling. It's great. It's really well done.
Yeah. And Juan Figueroa's art, there's some very upsetting character designs in here. In particular, it's mostly talking. There's not a lot of action necessarily that goes on here, but it's all very dynamically drawn. So great stuff. Let's keep going with great comic books. Why not? Guilt Frame, number one, from Dark Horse Comics, written by Matt Kent and Margie Kraft-Kent, art by Matt Kent. Again, this is a book that Matt Kent teased a couple of months back when he was on our live show. So check that out if you want to hear more about it. But this is a mystery series about a aunt and nephew, I believe.
Written by a mom and son.
Yeah, I mean, we know what's going on
there. We know what's going on. And is there more of a mom and son storyline than, like, fancy chairs that you got to keep track of? Like, let's go.
Yeah. I had a great time with this. I mean, Matt Kidd, always great on art. This is less esoteric than Mind Management and a lot of his other work. It's a little more straightforward, or at least it seems to be based on the first issue. But we are following these great detectives who are an aunt and a nephew who have solved multiple mysteries. They become embroiled in a new mystery that involves these, as you mentioned, fancy chairs. It's fun. It's fancy funny. Chairs. There's some emotional stuff going on in the background. I love the weird character quirks. It feels like if you liked Glass Onion and Knives Out, I think you're going to enjoy this as well, because the same sort of like arch light tone going on here to the mystery.
Well, there's so much dread created that is like some weird slicing of what looks like fingers, and it's chicken. There's a lot of the like the stakes. We're getting murder adjacent things that then it's like, what's this chair mystery about? I'm caught up in it. Like, I want him to track down who's fucking with their chairs. It's like the movie Phenomenon. He bought her chairs.
It's funny, too, because the first couple of pages are a very classic Matt Kidd construction where it starts with something. If I remember correctly, it starts with something that you're like, oh, it's a blood stain. And it keeps zooming out. Is that right? And it ultimately becomes something very different over the course of the pages. You're like, ah, okay, we're deconstructing the comic book form. But after that point, not really.
It starts close up on a red panel and reveals, and it doesn't look like anything. And then it is a blood. It's a murderer.
A murder, but then it continues to zoom out onto a phone. And then we get more of a zoom out. So it's very much like, this is Monkhead. He's constructing a comic that is a comic. It kind of settles down into a fun, goofy mystery. It's a good time.
Yeah, agree. And the art really works with it. Matt Kent's art is excellent. He brings such a wry tone to the writing, obviously, but also the art. That's great.
Johnny Quest, number one, from Dynamite, written by Joe Casey, art by Sebastian Perez. This is another Warner Brothers title after Powerpuff Girls and Space Ghost and Thundercats. I'll be honest, other than Venture Brothers, this is not something that I was necessarily familiar with.
You didn't watch Johnny Quest?
I didn't watch Johnny Quest.
Holy shit. The best show. Like, in a world of like Hanna-Barbera cartoons where they're a little goofy, this cartoon went so hard for like the 60s. Yeah, it was like had this great like soundtrack that was like super like James Bondy, very high action. And it's a little weird because it's like four dudes hanging out. Like, two dad figures and two boy figures, and you're sort of like, anybody else around you can hang out with? Like, any women? No, just these men and boys. But this comic takes that sort of vibe of very much going hard with real action. There's a sense of dread whenever I was watching the original Johnny Quest cartoon, and it really translates to this comic. This comic goes hard, I felt like.
It does. I was, to be honest, like a little worried getting into it because Joe Casey can be this is almost opposite of what I was saying with Matt Kidd. Like, I like it when Matt Kidd gets esoteric and plays with the form. Joe Casey is often working at another level where I'm like, I just can't get out of your vibe, man.
I love when Joe Casey gets on one. Like, was his comic Butcher Baker or The Righteous Maker about a truck driver who was just like fucking shit up? I was like, yes, okay. And this has that energy, but for a licensed property.
Here's what I'd say about it is, not knowing a lot about Johnny Quest, it sets up the premise and the characters very simply, and then gives you a wild Joe Casey style twist that then he settles down into for in a way that you can understand it. Like, there's enough to hold on to here that I thought it was very interesting.
Yeah, and like, I thought it was going to be like, it's very Johnny Quest has some Scooby-Doo energy where it's like, who could be responsible for these lizard men invading our home? And it's like, oh, it's the other character we met. But this sort of takes that, you know, in the first few pages and really blows it out in a way that I really liked.
Did it remind you at all of that terrible interview we did with the Venture Brothers?
Yes, that, I recall that yearly we would do that. The years we were doing coverage for Newsarama, we interviewed the Venture Brothers guys every year, and every year they would sit down and be, I could see in their eyes, like, all they want to do is fuck with us. They don't want to answer a single real question we have, and they want to fuck around. And every time they did it, I was like, let's go. I'll ride the lightning with you. Because, I mean, be honest, like, no one wants to hear a bunch of questions about next season of Venture Brothers. You want to get weird? I'll get weirder, is what I said.
Meanwhile, I was, like, flop sweating in the middle of those interviews because I was the one who was like, I got to get some news out here. Oh, God. And they hated it.
It was always a fun thing. It was always late. It was like the second to last interview we always did. And we're so tired. And we're like, hey, we just interviewed Stan Lee for like 40 minutes about something he doesn't really care about. And then we're like jumping in with those guys.
It's me, Stan Lee. And check out the new soda that I've created.
Yeah, it's like, oh, I love putting bubbles in it. We were like, oh, cool. Okay.
We love comics and we love talking to people about comics. From the world of Minor Threats, Barfly number 2 from Dark Horse Comics, written by Kyle Starks, art by Ryan Brown. Of course, this is Spinning Off the World, created by Patton Oswalt and Jordan Bloom. Here we're following a henchman, Hot World. Headed to the old movie theater by way of Netflix, I guess. And that's not
the movie. Not the old movie theater. The new movie theater, Your Home.
Yes. The personal movie theater. This is following a henchman who is a fly, and his old boss who controls bugs comes back and really messes up things for him. Everything about Minor Threats is good. This one is just super sad and poignant because you really feel for this fly character. You really want him to just have a normal life, playing his guitar, hanging out at the bar, and that's it. And he can't do it.
No. I really enjoyed this. I feel like, I mean, Kyle Starks has written a ton of comics, so it really feels very focused on this single story that we're getting into. And it was fun. I mean, I was trying to make the comp. Is it like a Baxter Stockman thing? Is it like an Ant-Man thing? And it feels like it's sort of neither of those, but also borrowing a little bit from them in some ways. So, I really like this.
Yeah, that's one of the things I like about Minor Threats is, and we talked about this, not to keep plugging live shows, but when they were on the live show, is it's not like this is the Justice League very thinly veiled. It actually is original characters in a new way. And I think we're even getting that with our Bug Lord villain here. But I don't know. I love the place that Kyle Starks find it. His humor is always really good. Ryan Brown is a perfect compliment here. He just draws really good comedy as well. And he gets a lot out of a character who has no facial expressions whatsoever. That's very impressive. Werewolf by Night, Red Band, number 1 from Marvel, written by Jason Liu, art by Sergio Davila, spinning off of the Werewolf by Night one-shot and a bunch of other issues. We are getting Werewolf by Night is now living in a castle. That was Dracula's castle, maybe? And
it appeared in the Rocky Mountains in a previous Werewolf by Night story.
Yes.
So he's,
and then,
like, he's tapping the Rockies Coors Light style.
I apologize. The Hood, meanwhile, is taking over Dracula's castle.
Right.
I'll tell you what. A lot going on in this book.
Yes, and seemingly pretty different things. Like, the Hood stuff feels so much different from Jack Russell's, like, his whole thing. Again, his name's Jack Russell, and he's the Werewolf by Night. He's like, strap me down, I keep killing. And Elsa Bloodstone's like, I just cut off a blood hunt. So, like, this issue has the quickest summation of the blood hunt, where Werewolf by Night is like, hey, it's dark for like a day and a half. Weird. Anyway, I woke up a little
that
crazy.
Was, I will say, my favorite part of the issue is the two-page splash that was like, blood hunt happens.
Yeah.
Very funny.
That's how I'm putting it in my biography as well. Blood hunt happens and moving
totally
on.
That's the most important part of my life, is that blood hunt happened.
Varney's one of my godfathers.
Varney is actually my emergency contact. In case it isn't clear, there's too much going on in this book, and to the point that every other page has, like, see this other issue to understand what's going on here, which is wild for a book that should just be about, like, a werewolf takes over a castle that is full of tentacles. Fun concept. Just stay on that. Don't give me the rest of the stuff.
Well, I think the issue is, like, Werewolf by Night doesn't have a lot of series going on. Like, it's very much like, do you see this one shot from like 4 years ago? It's like, okay, yeah, no, but sure. So, like, they're stitching that together. The Elsa Bloodstone, I actually like the Elsa Bloodstone Werewolf by Night connection. I think they're sort of almost rom-com is really interesting, and I wish this book would do that.
Yeah. We'll see. Action Comics.
One more thing on it. I didn't really get the red band of this. And that feels like a little
out,
bit.
He squeezes out some eyeballs, I guess. I don't know. Here's the thing. Nothing against our good friends at Marvel. I don't think they can properly execute an actual red band, to be honest with you.
Wow. Because they're not crazy enough?
No, they can't put it's actual just, blood on the page. It's Marvel. It's a mainstream publisher where kids, even with the red label, may accidentally pick it up. And I don't think they can. I mean, granted, we talked about X-Factor, which I do think is transgressive in a very clear way, but that is textual, not visual.
Yeah.
Distillery is putting out red label books. They have The Missionary, their book by Ryan Stegman and Jason Howard, I want to say, is going to be red label. That's something that's like probably going to have nudity, probably going to have actually some ultra violence. But here, yeah, it's just like squeezing out some eyeballs. Even the Blood Hunt red band was like, we're chopping some people in half. I don't know that anybody could really do that properly other than like Juan Jose Rip is the main person that I'm like, that's gross. That is a gross thing that you did.
Right.
Most artists just don't draw that.
Yeah. And because they're not called to.
Yeah.
Because of that, all of that. All the reasons we're saying.
Let's talk about something that is earnest and sweet instead. Action Comics 1068 from DC Comics, written by Gail Simone and Rainbow Rowell, art by Eddie Barrows and Sian Torme. In the front story, Superman is following a challenge from some aliens in order to save Earth. In the back story, Superman and Lois Lane are spatting over her being editor-in-chief of the Daily Planet and saying, hey, it is a conflict of interest for you, Clark Kent, to cover Superman. Both of these stories are great in entirely different ways. I love them. You know, this is not a knock on Gail Simone, but she is 100% channeling the John Byrne era for here with like...
I mean, it literally says on the title page, dedicated to two of the all-time giants, Denny O'Neil and Neil Adams. So she's fully channeling.
100%. Like, it is classic Superman. I love it. Like, it is her channeling that perfectly. It's very fun. It's some fun old-school Superman and Lois Lane and Jimmy adventures. But man, I know I talked about this with the last issue, but the Rainbow Rally Sand Torby, that is so underlining every argument that anybody has ever had about, like, oh, you can't have conflict with married characters unless they're breaking up or cheating on each other. This is such a clear conflict that's going on here that ties into something that is legit, like an actual conflict of interest. It's doing it so smartly. I'm not worried about them breaking up, but like, it is an actual conflict with Lois and Clark, and I love that. I love that she has found that place.
Well, it's nice because it's justified in that neither of them are wrong, technically. It's like a good fight between any couple where you're like, yeah, they both probably have a point. Otherwise, they wouldn't be together. So, like, that tracks in a really good way. And I also love that the front story, the Gail Simone story, is such a classic tale. And this backstory is such a modern tale. And what a great package.
Yeah, totally agree. This is great. I mean, I don't know how this is selling necessarily, but I love the Superman All-Stars label, just giving people a chance to do, hey, do a three-issue arc of the Superman story that you've always wanted to tell. That's great.
100%.
Karnak the Mystic, number one from Archie Comics, written by Joe Corallo, art by Butch Mappa. We had them on the live show. Please check it out because we talked to them about this book. But this is a revamp of a classic character, a mystic who is a down-on-his-luck magician who discovers a medallion that can help him become intangible and jump to other places, I guess is what's going on there. But also there's a demonic price to it. I thought this was a lot of fun, like a lot of these one-shots. And honestly, I know we've talked to Jamie Rattata, who's the editor here, but I really wish they would continue these. Like, it's my big bummer about this stuff is, like, all of these are great pilots and then you never see these characters again.
Well, it's wild that Archie Comics is publishing so many interesting stories that have nothing to do with Archie, the character. Mm-hmm. Like, the bulk of their books are not Archie-related, I feel like. So that's crazy. And the fact that they're all very good. Like, this is a great story. I said it on the live show, it's very, like, if you're a fan of, like, Zatanna, Zatara, some, like, standalone Doctor Strange stuff, this feels very much in that world. And just a good story, told well, great synergy between the writing and the art. Good book.
Iron Fist, 50th anniversary special from Marvel, written by Chris Claremont. Excuse me, Alyssa Wong, Justina Ireland, Frank Thierry, and Jason Liu. Art by Lan Medina, Von Rundahl, Elena Casagrande, Ty Templeton, and Wils Portacio. We are getting a bunch of stories from throughout the history of Iron Fist with various Iron Fists throughout here, leading from the past all the way up through the modern era. We should probably talk about the modern era one, because that's certainly the big one that happens here. But what did you think about this overall, Justin?
It made me want more Iron Fist stuff. Like, I feel like we haven't had a definitive Iron Fist story in a while. Like, when was sort of one that really popped? Was it the Kari Andrews from a few years ago is more recent? The Matt Fraction run is maybe the bigger one. From, I don't know, what is that, 10 years ago now?
Yeah, maybe more.
What is anything? Yeah, at least that. And I think we're ready to reboot this character. Like, we talk a lot about the Hawkeye-ification of characters and how it's good to do, like, a deep dive, creative, forward take on characters. And Iron Fist sort of had one already, but I think it's time for another one. Because this, just reading all these stories, I was like, I like all the elements here. I like the classic nature. I like Danny Rand is such a goof. I don't really know the sort of newer Iron Fist characters as much. They haven't been featured very much. But the look, the feel, the tone is right there, ready for a modern take.
And I'll throw out there, I thought both Alyssa Wong and Justina Ireland's stories were very good. Alyssa Wong was the one focusing on the new Iron Fists, if I remember correctly. Very fun, good dynamic there. I thought that was great. Justina Ireland's one, again, if I remember correctly, is Colleen Wing and Misty Knight teaming up with Danny Rand at the community center.
Yeah, that's fun sort of comedy.
Just good comedy there. Like, very delightful. The big one, though, to get into spoilers, the final story in the issue, I thought this was absolutely insane that they did this for a 50th anniversary special. And just they snuck in a story that is Danny Rand's birthday party, and he very casually mentions to Luke Cage and the other dude that is there that, hey, usually Iron Fists are killed at age 33 by these beasts that come to kill them and take their hearts and bring them to the Dragon Shaolin. But that didn't happen to me. I'm 34 now. As you could probably guess, by the end of the story, Danny Rand has been killed and his heart has been taken out by one of these beasties. They killed Danny Rand in the Iron Fist 50th anniversary special. What do you think about that, Justin?
I mean, bummed. Like I'm saying, like, I think I want the reboot. I want the new version here. Yeah, and it felt strange. It almost felt like, look, because I think, isn't there a little postscript there that's like, look, we did this, huh? And I was like, what is this, a dare?
The problem is the art isn't clear because we're told that this beastie that I don't remember the name of is going to kill him and rip out his heart. We get kind of a battle of that per discussion about Red Band and showing explicit things. It cuts to a black page, and then the editor is like, ah, Danny Rand, too bad.
Long live Danny Rand, it says.
Yeah, which is very nonspecific, but he goes on to be like, we'll miss you, Danny Rand, by the end. So it's clear that they meant him to be killed. I assume the story is this dude who is masquerading as Razor Fist is going to go after the two new younger Iron Fists. We'll see him attack them, and then ultimately Danny Rand will come back and be resurrected in some way. But it's wild of Marvel, and I'll honestly say, like, kudos to them for sneaking under the radar a death of a major character in a 50th anniversary special,
but it feels like they're setting up what you're saying where, I mean, the last words are immortal Danny Rand.
And yes.
So like, I think we're going to get that.
That. And also when the editor is highlighting a bunch of the issues, he's like, you'd be naive to think Danny Rand would die and never come back. So there you go.
Great lesson from an editor.
Absolutely. Transformers number 11 from Image Comics, written by Daniel Warren Johnson, art by Jorge Corona. In this issue, our robots in disguise are banging up against a bunch of other robots in disguise, and it's a real clash of metal.
A lot of metal banging on each other, as you're saying. Shouts to Beachcomber, the dune buggy Transformer that I definitely had when I was a kid, and I was happy to see him here. He's a fun Transformer.
Yes, he surfs in, and he's like, I want nothing to do with this bud.
Yeah, because he's bad just accent. Like,
I don't know what I just did there.
I don't know what was that meant to be, a California Surfer? Or?
It was supposed to be California Surfer, but it ended up like kind of being Beatles, but not exactly.
Yeah, nice. Classic mix up. The Beatles from England and a California surfer dude. I will say he shouldn't have had a pina colada in his hand, because where does he drink it? I don't know. Or does he use it to oil his joints?
Yeah. What is it? Is it like coconut and motor oil? And that's it?
Yeah. Pina Caluba? And just to talk about the book, I do think this title has gotten a little bit like, we've seen them bang into each other. We've seen Optimus Prime be like, we're barely getting away with this one. Or like, I think I need, and I know, isn't Daniel Warren Johnson leaving this book after next issue?
Maybe they haven't said it. They haven't announced anything, which is surprising, but I kind of assume so.
That's what was my thought too. And I'm just like, what? I need a sort of a return to your corners, Autobots and Decepticons, and reset.
I agree. Thank you for saying what needed to be said while Pete is not on the podcast. I agree with you.
Smart, right?
Yeah. Kill All Immortals, number 2 from Dark Horse Comics, written by Zach Kaplan, art by Fico Osio. We also had Zach on the podcast a couple of weeks back, but this is about a immortal, per the title, who has fallen in love with a human, brings him back to meet her family, except her family has all been, up to you, cursed or blessed by the Norse gods to live forever, and they are hunting him down, and by extension her down. They're on the run this issue. We get a bunch of more mythology stuff. Great action in this issue. Great character development. I'm really digging this series. This is like balls to the wall action from front to back.
Yeah, I mean, this is going to sound like, I don't mean this as an insult, but it's sort of like if Thor, the movie Thor, was like a Fast and Furious movie where it's like very aggressive, very like, oh, let's just go. And it has shades of like Deadpool where like everyone's just like, am I going to survive through this? I just got shot 19 times. And yes, the answer is yes. You're a main character. But it is good. I really like the art in this. It really uses some great the dips into reds. I thought it were really well done in this.
Spider Society, number 1 from Marvel, written by Alex Segura, art by Scott Godlewski, per the title. This is about Miles and Gwen hanging out with a bunch of multiversal Spider-Mens, and there is a new threat that is attacking them. I thought there was good, fun action in this issue. But if you're a fan of the Spider-Verse movies, this is probably a good one to pick up.
Yeah, I like the new spider characters introduced. We get this Weapon 8, I believe is his name, who's like a Wolverine Spider-Man or a Spider-Man who went through the Weapon X program, which is fun. I mean, I don't know if Madame Web has just been ruined in general, but like all of her being like, I suddenly can't quite see the future. I was like, get out of here.
Yeah,
get,
go. You just need a Pepsi. You need a Pepsi. I will say I kind of love the ramen Spider-Man or Spider Ramen or whatever it was.
Yeah, I believe it's Spider Ramen.
Great stuff.
Yeah. Which is like literally a bowl of ramen that is also a spider hero.
It's good.
I don't know. Outside of that one panel, I don't know what the application is. Besides,
I
could just a big old slurp.
I love ramen and I love Spider-Man, so. Dot, dot, dot.
But you're going to eat that hero.
Oh, yeah.
You're that hero's Green Goblin. Because you're just trying to, Spider Ramen, says Alex.
I'm going to eat Spider-Man and then Spider Ramen.
Yeah. And you've become the villain you've always been destined to be.
Just like they said in The Dark Knight, Gotham City Sirens, number 2 from DC Comics, written by Leah Williams, art by Daniel Hilliard. At the end of the last issue, we found out the punchline is the villain here going up against Harley Quinn, Poison Ivy, Catwoman, and White Rabbit. And they go on the offensive in this issue. This continues to be a lot of fun. I like this as a 4-issue event. Good stuff.
Agree. This is great. Like to see all these characters together. Very well told. The art's really nice, really clean lines. The White Rabbit of it all is bothering me a little bit because Marvel Comics has a White Rabbit that is sort of the same thing. And she was recently featured in the Spider-Man crossover where they had to like take over parts of New York. And she did the same thing where she was like, I'm captured, I guess. And I was like, why are there both of these characters doing the same things?
I'm not sure.
Speak for White Rabbit, Alex. Defend this rabbit.
I believe in White Rabbit. I am voting for White Rabbit in November, and White Rabbit is going to be the next president of the United States.
Wow. Well, which one is my question? I think you've been fooled. You've been White Rabbit-pilled.
I think you know which one I'm talking about. Wolverine Annual 2024, number 1 from Marvel, written by Ezra Clayton Daniels, art by Yildiray Senar. We are following Wolverine as he tackles now with 2 bearers of the Infinity Stone, the Synthesoid one and the other one who is strong.
It's the Power Stone and the Soul Stone.
But his name's not Power Stone anymore. It's Ajax and other guy.
No, his name is literally, I think his name is Other One, I believe. And the other guy, the synthesoid, is named something else. I'll tell you in a second. But yes, go ahead.
Yeah. All I will say about this is I actually like this Infinity Stone event that is happening through these annuals. I was a little iffy when it was just one-on-one, but I feel like there's a good build going on here. I like how they're fleshing out these characters. I think it's interesting. I don't know what it's going towards. Maybe a new Infinity Watch team or something like that, but there's a fair amount of empathy going on from Wolverine, and maybe this is a side effect of Uncanny X-Men where he showed that as well, but I'm really into a Wolverine that's not just like, I'm going to slash and slice everybody, but yeah, a sensitive Wolverine. I'm into it.
It's Apex, a.k.a. Other Apex. One, who has the Power Stone, and Multitude, a.k.a. Ward, who's a synthesoid who has the Soul Stone. So it's there's a lot of extra naming going on there. Those characters are, it's still not quite coming into place what the deal is with them. Mm-hmm. I don't know. The Power Stone seems to be, he just is a jerk and is strong. The Soul Stone seems to be connected to souls, can sometimes conjure souls. In the previous annual we read last week, it was able to conjure any hero, including Fin Fang Foom. So not quite sure what the power set is. But I like this story a lot because I think this very effectively used Wolverine, had Wolverine on a mission to go pay his respects to Rose from Wolverine Origins, his first redheaded love from back in the day. And the Soul Stone really had a huge emotional effect on Wolverine, spoke to what he was actually doing up there before he was bumped into by these Infinity Watch people. And I thought this was actually a really great Wolverine story, despite it like sort of unrelated to the Infinity Watch stuff.
Yeah, I like this, and I also like the backup with Coulson and Fury. I thought that was fun. Overall, I think this is a good
idea. Yes, I just don't know what's happening in the Deathstone stuff. It just feels like, and like the choice of Nighthawk as the sort of antagonist here, I'm like, why are we having all these supreme power characters?
I don't know.
They're being made to have such an impact, and I'm like, what? Why? I don't know about them.
Sir, number one from Boom Studios by Phil Hound. This is a book about a guy who loved a girl and lost her and finds her, except she is part of a death motorcycle race rally.
Classic twist. That's a classic twist.
Yep.
This is fun.
Is it? You seem unsure.
I don't know. Like, this is a book that I was like, cool. I'm just not my flavors.
Yeah,
you know?
I wanted to like it more than I did.
Yes, this book, it would be a book I would be like, is maybe more Alex flavored.
This is a weird problem because I don't really like this, but it starts in the middle. It starts with, like, we've been in a relationship for a while and what's going on here versus I love, let's go with death motorcycle races. Very fun when they get to that. Yeah. Enjoyable.
But Star should have started there, you're saying.
Exactly. Versus the relationship stuff I can't get into because I don't know these characters yet and I don't care about them. So I don't know. But I'm intrigued.
Nice. Well, is there any other relationship books we have on tap for the evening?
Oh, sure do, Justin. The next one is Sensational She-Hulk, number 10 from Marvel, written by Rainbow Rowell, once again, art by Andre Ginelet. This is gut-wrenchingly the last issue of this book. We find She-Hulk dealing with her relationship with both the Avengers as well as Jack of Hearts and Hellcat. As well, blanked on the name there for a second. Man, I'm bummed to see the series go, but what a lovely ending here. The series was great.
Really loved it. Loved the sort of rom-com aspect that we had between She-Hulk and Jack of Hearts. Really fun. There's little like comedy moments, like sort of rom-com flavored comedy throughout. Imagine falling in love with a man who has hearts all over his outfit. Very fun. And it felt like it ended in a place that was sort of like, well, She-Hulk's going to join the Avengers. Actually, maybe she should just continue on in a book like this, was the final takeaway. Yeah. Even though the book isn't happening, I was like, oh, it's a double punch to have it be like, this is the best place for her to be. I was like, oof, got me.
Yeah. And it really is. This was great. If you didn't check this out, if you didn't check She-Hulk by Rainbow Rowell out as well, do pick it up. Just one of the best comic
so
books.
Good. Yeah.
Heartpiercer, number 4 from Dark Horse Comics, written by Rich Dueck, art by Gavin Smith. This is a fantasy book set in a world where evil has taken over the world and eliminated all the beasts except for the really gross beasts like werewolves.
Yeah, the yuckies.
And the Heartpiercer is fighting back against them. She ultimately reaches her destiny here. This is very much an open ending for a second series, and I do hope they have more. This is a fun fantasy world they've set up.
Yeah, and like it's sort of a beasts. There's an environmental message sort of underneath here, and like a just a core regret that we get to see sort of served up for the benefit of our hero right at the end here. Shouts to the unicorn helmet. Looking forward to more of that in the future.
Falling in Love on the Path to Hell, number 3 from Image Comics, written by Jerry Duggan, art by Gary Brown. We are following a bunch of warriors who were sent to a purgatory-style island and are forced to fight. However, we have a gunslinger and a, I don't know, samurai, ronin, whatever she is, who don't really want to fight, and they are slowly falling in love on the path to hell.
Yeah, as the title suggests, this book is a dark story, and the art is sort of echoing that with like this very gritty, reminds me of the art for the pirate stuff in Watchmen, very much like the tone is that way. It feels like just absolutely bleak, and there's just scraps of love, but we're not getting fireworks here. We're just getting some, like, a lit match in the middle of a dink.
Yeah, that's my problem, is I'm not really feeling the love of the title yet. There's not a lot of heat there versus...
I mean, it's so bleak. Yeah. So, like, maybe the next issue feels like maybe that's going to be the all-sex issue that you've been waiting for, right, Alex?
Yeah, I'd love to see some explicit sex.
On the path to hell, says Alex.
Yeah. Is there any explicit sex on the internet? Have you ever seen that?
On the internet? I don't know. You probably have to punch in a search term. Yeah. Right, Alex?
I don't use search engines.
I don't traffic in search terms.
Yes.
I let the pornography come to me, you know?
Email it to me.
Give me your best.
Or better yet, mail it to me. Snail mail it to me.
Exactly. I'll take a magazine, sir.
Mm-hmm. Ultraman X Avengers, number 1 from Marvel, written by Kyle Higgins and Matt Groom, art by Francesco Mana. This is the team from the Massiverse, Radiant Black in particular, taking on Ultraman, the character, meeting up with the Avengers. Mostly Miles Morales in this issue.
Miles Morales focus title with a non-vamped Miles. We got Smiles. He's all smiles,
and we get to see some of the other Avengers as well. I don't know much about Ultraman, but I do know about the Avengers and Miles Morales, and from that perspective, I think this was a fun mashup. What did you think?
They definitely sort of give you a little Ultraman education where over the course of the book, you're like, I actually become Ultraman. And like, really, they ease into it and in a way where you can follow the action. Miles feels a little out of place as sort of the key character here, to the point where he's like, hey, the Avengers are here and the other Spider-Man is here. And I'm like, what? Why would you have both of them be here? That's very weird. So I don't know. The choices feel a little strange. I am curious in that there's a mild cliffhanger here that I will spoil. It's not like a reveal. It's just they're going to be fighting two giant kaiju next episode. So that could be fun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think Francesco Mana's art is good. Kyle Higgins' Backroom clearly know you know, Ultraman style heroes from working on the Massiverse. I had a good time reading this. I thought this was a fun crossover. I'll also mention there's a Spider-Man Ultraman thing that Viz is doing at the same time. So you can check that out online as well if you're interested. Green Lantern number 14 from DC Comics, written by Jeremy Adams and Mark Guggenheim, art by Fernando Pissarin and Derek Robertson. The front story is a absolute power tie-in as Hal Jordan tries to escape from Amanda Waller. The backup is introducing us to the Shadow Lanterns.
Yeah, what's up with these guys? This was very strange.
Yeah, it was weird.
I didn't know. I was like, oh, this seems... Because it also is a hard end to it. It's not very much to be continued. I was like, oh, they just got killed.
I like the front story, though. I liked Hal Jordan die-harding his way out of the Task Force X headquarters. That was very fun. Carol Ferris also being very conflicted about it. I'll mention, if you didn't read the Absolute Power Task Force 7 issue that came out last week.
Three.
Definitely read that. Because
Alan Scott.
Yeah, that is
super. And then one of the Amazos,
It's super really important for this. But this was a great follow-up to it, and I continue to really enjoy this event.
Yeah, I mean, I got to say, I feel like Green Lantern in general has been charting a very different path from the last, like, decade of Hal Jordan. Hal Jordan is back to being sort of a fuck-up. Mm-hmm. When he became, like, sort of just another Barry Allen for a while, very just on it and serious. And I think it's been a really smart transition here, and they're continuing it forward in this this issue.
Yeah, it's great, and it uses so many different corners of the DC universe as he just pulls out various weapons that have been confiscated by Matt Waller. I thought this was really fun. Immortal Thor, number 14 from Marvel, written by Al Ewing, art by Jen Basaldúa. Thor and Herc are in some sort of underworld type situation and fighting Zeus and Nyx. Lots going on.
And Loki's there too.
Sure is. I've said this before with this comic book, but I am very like literally 50-50 where I read an issue and I'm like, this is great. And then I read the issue and I'm like, I don't know what's going on here. This is one of those, I don't know what is going on here.
Well, it feels straight, and it feels like we walk away from this being like, Thor has a lot of juice right now. I'm like, oh, okay, well, that's cool. See where that goes. But I'm also like, shouldn't he be on Earth trying to fight these people who are the Roxxon people who are making him dumb on Earth? Mm-hmm. And it just feels strange. I feel like they really sold through this idea that Thor has been ruined on Earth by Roxxon publishing a comic that rewrites his brain or something like in that. It's very much that. And then he's been like, I'm leaving. And now we've had these sort of wanders that are interesting, but it feels like we have a central spine that you laid out that you're avoiding. The narrative seems to be purposefully avoiding that. And that's not something that Thor does. So I'd either like to hear that he's doing that on purpose or have him go back and deal with what's been laid out for him.
Totally agree with that. I will also throw out there on the more positive, Jen Basaldúa draws a very nice Herc. I think Hercules is really good in this issue. My main problem is we get a cliffhanger here, like you're saying, with a powered up Thor, where I'm like, are we going to follow up on this? I'm not 100% sure with this title at this point.
Yeah.
So we'll see. Midst. Address Unknown from Dark Horse Comics, written by Colin Lorimer, art by Alejandro Aragon. This is taking place in a world where there's a dark place and a light place as people are colonizing a new island that has a little bit of both of that. Is this based on a video game?
I honestly don't know, but my take was like, this is like playing... This is like watching someone play Final Fantasy in the middle for like an hour. Yeah. Where you're like, oh, that's cool. They're sort of doing this stuff. Oh, there's a monster there they have to beat. That's cool. Like, I like the story. I like the characters. I think that the art's well done. But I was like, this is a wild world to just parachute into. And then you walk out of it and you're like, oh, no real takeaway? I thought it was going to be to be continued or something.
Yeah. No, I have no idea. And mind you, I should have looked up exactly what's going on here. I do think the art is good and the character designs are good. The creature designs, the evil creatures that attack them.
Spikies?
In the darkness, the spikies are pretty cool. I think they look like mole worm type things. I'm intrigued by this world, but this definitely feels like a video game play dynamic that I'm just not familiar with.
You just dropped in the midst of it. It's right in the title, ooh. Alex.
Rifters, number three from Image Comics, written by Brian Posehn and Joe Troman, art by Chris Johnson. This is a book about time cops, but not like the movie.
Yeah, wow. Oh, you seem so disappointed. So disappointed.
I don't know, man. I'm a Van Damme. I'm Van Damned.
You're Van Damned. And I've said that. You were cursed by JCVD a while ago to rewatch his movies on a daily basis. I mean, this comic is fun. I feel like sometimes it has a hard time balancing its tones of like fun time travel action and comedy.
I agree with you. I think there's some fun stuff in here, but it's not quite coming together with me, which is unfortunate. But why don't we move on? Talk about X-Men, number two from Marvel, written by Jed McKay, art by Ryan Stegman. We were pretty down on the first issue, I think. There was stuff we liked, but it was not the greatest setup. Here we're getting the X-Men.
You reviewed that. I think I wasn't on that show. So that was you and Pete. Okay. And I'm curious, like, Pete's down because Cyclops is at the center here.
Sure.
And I do think the Uncanny X-Men that Gail Simone did, was that last week, that we loved, is almost a counterposition from this sort of militaristic, mm-hmm. very much like all action, no fucking around take that this book has. And I do think this issue is continuing that.
Yes. My issue with the first issue was that it was not new reader friendly. It was very much dealing with the hangover from Krakoa. It was very much like, whoa, 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 calm down. I know you're upset about Krakoa ending. Here's what this new team is. What Uncanny X-Men gave me was, we're bummed about this, but also we are this own thing, and you could just hand this issue to literally anybody and be like, this is why X-Men is great, versus X-Men number one, it was not that. X-Men mm-hmm. number two, I think, gets a little closer to that. It's a fun adventure where we get the team dealing with an alien invasion. I wish the twist wasn't so obvious in terms of where the alien invasion is coming from. But I do like how the team works here. There's some fun moments. I think Jed McKay is trying to channel big Grant Morrison-style action moments, but not necessarily with the big ideas is what I'm getting here. So I don't know. I'm curious to see where this goes.
Well, I do think, like, this is just sort of pure id Cyclops of, like, I will never fail. And so it's like, he just says like, let's never fail. And everyone has to do a good job. And I think that's just a little bit of a naked driving point. I want to understand. I want some emotionality underneath that. There is some fun here. The Juggernaut and Edie stuff, I thought was fun.
Great. In turning Juggernaut into a bullet and then cutting to, is it Ileana and Psylocke? Or like, Psylocke. Cool. You turned him into a bullet. That's fun. A fun moment, but yes, I think you're absolutely right. And this gets back to keep talking about Grant Morrison, but like his early new X-Men issues, if I remember correctly, were very much devoid of character and emotion. They were very much like, we're boots on the ground. Let's go. We're X-Men. Action, action, action. And eventually Grant Morrison's run boiled down to much more, hey, man, Emma Frost and Cyclops are having an affair in the White Hot Room. This is fucked up for Jean Grey. And that was the way more interesting stuff that was going on in that run.
Came alive at that moment is the flashpoint of his run, I feel like, where it was like, holy shit, he's been doing this all along. And then from then on, it was big emotional reveal after big emotional reveal.
Yes.
So maybe that's where we're headed. I hope so.
Yes, absolutely. I like Jed MacKay. Ryan Stegman's art is great. I think all of his character designs are interesting, but this very much feels like almost done in one set up things, and I'm waiting for the rug pull on this title.
And maybe that's, it feels like it's coming. There's definitely some cracks in the wall already. Like, I don't know what Magneto's deal is, but he seems
I don't know. He's sitting in a chair. He's bearded. There needs to be some explanation there.
So, and maybe we're just setting a vibe that will then be disrupted, which is cool.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about a vibe that is totally disrupted with Outsiders number 10 from DC Comics, written by Colin Kelly and Jackson Lansing, art by Robert Carey. What we've built up over the past 9 issues is that the drummer is secretly Jaquita Wagner, member of Planetary, who just wants to get back to the Wildstorm universe, and she will do anything to achieve that goal. And in fact, everything that has happened up to this point has been all part of her plan to destroy the DC universe and a return to the Wildstorm universe. And in this issue, Batwing and Batwoman try to stop her. Man, this is great. Like, I love that they do exactly what we were just talking about, where they took a bunch of done-in-one stories that seem to be done-in-one and have built them up to a crescendo that is as bad as it possibly can be.
Agree. It's, and this book is so focused both in what you're saying and also the fact that they're not doing the easy thing of expanding this to like, oh, Martian Manhunter's here and like the Titans or whatever. It's still the same characters. They're still trying to figure it out. They're solving the problem internally. And that's great. And so I just like, I want to applaud specifically the focus here because it's really, really working.
I agree with you. I mean, not to blow this out too much, but I don't know if people talk about this with the MCU necessarily anymore, but I remember there's always this thing with the MCU movies where people would say, why isn't Iron Man there? Why isn't Thor there? Why isn't Captain America there? And the answer is like, it's not their fucking movie. Like, they are not in it. What would be gained by putting Iron Man in this Thor movie versus focusing on Thor? And I think it's the same thing with this, where it's like the main characters of this book are 3 characters, Batwoman, Batwing, and Jaquita Wagner.
Yeah.
Keep it focused on that. That makes it a strong title. That's where we can go from there.
100%. And I also am like, the reason those characters aren't there is because they just weren't there. It's like when something, you're like, hey, where is my mom? And it's like, I don't know, something doing something else. She wasn't there when that happened. It's okay.
I wonder that. I will tell you, it was a little confusing when I was watching Iron Man 2 and my mommy wasn't there.
Yeah. Believe me, I was wondering about your mommy too. And she'll... Oh. Your face just changed.
Yeah, I just lit up at the thought of my mommy in Iron Man 2.
You love your mommy. You love your mommy.
I do. I love my mama. Mama. Profane, number 3 from Boom Studios, written by Peter Milligan, art by Raul Fernandez. We are focusing on a character from a noir detective novel who has escaped into the real world and is trying to figure out the mystery of who is trying to kill his maker. Justin, you've been pretty stoked about this book. Take it away.
I highlighted this as a I really like the way this book is sort of, we talk a lot about stories, and this is doing a good job of sort of pushing against it. And something that Matt Kint does very well, I mentioned that in the live show, and sort of our main character is doing that, is able to sort of push on the format of the story and keep it fun. It reminds me of some old Fables Unwritten stuff that was happening back in the day. So if you're a fan of that, I think this is a good book to check out.
I totally agree. I'm really enjoying this. It is trippy. It is weird. Yeah, like you said, Unwritten, if you're a fan of that, check it out. Amazing Spider-Man number 55 from Marvel, written by Zeb Wells, art by Emilio Lazo. You know, for any of you who have been like, hey, man, you got rid of the marriage of Peter Parker and Mary Jane well over a decade ago. Where's all this dating you've been promising us? Guess what? He goes on a date in this issue. It all paid off.
And let me say, you know, we're in and out on Zeb Wells' run, and I think it's coming to a close pretty soon.
Yeah.
The last arc was a little all over the place with the spear and the goblin and the sins and all that. But man, this is a great standalone Spider-Man story. We start with the stereotype. He's always late. He always has to leave early and run out. And Zeb Wells just delivers a story that upsets that in an interesting way, puts the tension in it of like, why is she waiting for him here? Like you would drop this guy in a second, but then he finds a way to slingshot that back and make this feel like this could be a real relationship with, I believe the woman's name is Shay. I really enjoyed this.
I like this in theory. Maybe I'm just growing up, you know.
You're growing up in front of my eyes.
In front of your eyes,
in front of mommy,
a real man in front of mommy and dada. I don't know. I read this issue and it drove me absolutely insane. I was like, Jesus Christ, man, dress up for your date, get it together. I have seen you do this so many times, Just do it better. Like, just go on a date. Like, I understand in the middle of this date, Rhino and whoever interrupt the date.
Wow,
and that's a classic Spider-Man thing. That's fine. I'm fine with that. But the wrinkled white shirt that he's wearing to his date when she's dressed up, I know that is a Spider-Man trope. But I'm like, you're in your mid-30s now. Get it together, man. You suck. And this woman should leave because you suck. And I don't like reading a Spider-Man book where I'm like, I hate you, Spider-Man. Get your shit together.
Well, but I do think, yeah, I hear you. And there's definitely that in here. And that's the tension I was saying. But also, you know, he is Spider-Man.
I don't know. There's a difference between him showing up like that with like, Here's what I think, and this is maybe unfair to a fictional character or whatever, but there's a difference between him showing up like that to hanging out with Mary Jane or Gwen Stacy or whatever versus a new relationship that he's starting up. Like, dress fucking better on this date.
You're like you're not dressing up for your wife anymore, Alex, and I think you need to to iron your shirt.
Whoa, I'm talking about Amazing Spider-Man. You don't need to come for my marriage relationship is what I like to call
it. It just sounds like you're like, it's fine with your partner. It's fine with your Mary Jane or Gwen Stacy, but you're on a third date. Better look the part. And I want to say, what are you looking like?
Our wedding anniversary is coming up, and I'm straight up planning on wearing pajamas because I'm sleepy, man.
Yeah.
But nice. I'm not going on a first date with a sexy lady like Shay.
All right. Well, I don't know. I guess maybe you and Spider-Man have a lot to learn.
At equal amounts. The Domain, number 2 from Image Comics, written by Chip Zdarsky, art by Rachel Stott. This is a spinoff of Public Domain, focusing on the comic in the comic as 3 characters get fantastic powers via an alien. They're trying to figure it out in this issue. I was a little iffy about the first issue because I felt like it wasn't really paying off on the premise of being this revitalized, revamped comic that they were selling in Public Domain. I think they do that a little bit more in this issue in a nice way where they start to play with the idea of superheroes and who they can be. I thought this was pretty neat.
Yeah, and I wanted to shout out somebody in the Patreon Slack who was talking about how smartly they have really used the different creators involved in the
main. This was Derek, right?
Yes, Derek Mainhart, I believe. I was just looking it up, using the different creators in the main public domain book and really hearing their voices in the writing of this, the actual comic that they're creating. And that comment really lit this up for me because, like, that's cool. That's some really smart, very internal thinking from Chip Zdarsky.
And just to mention for anybody who is reading these paired books, so in public domain, they're trying to figure out how to create this comic. We've got an artist who is just like very earnest. He's a big, goofy guy. We've got the removed guy who is his brother. And we've got a woman who really wants to prove herself. And that's the characters that we have as the three characters who have taken over the domain. So, yeah, to the point that Derek Mainhart is making and Justin brought up, that's very much what we're getting here. Yeah. So I agree. I think Derek's comment was very apt. It really enriched the experience of reading the domain number two. So good stuff.
Stay enriched.
Stay enriched. Into the Unbeing, part one, number three, from Dark Horse Comics, written by Zach Thompson, art by Hayden Sherman. We mentioned this before with this book, that this is basically an Annihilation, the comic book, as we have a bunch of folks that are going deeper and deeper inside the body of what might be God, who is dead now. That was very much underlined in this issue. I think this was my favorite issue so far. The Hayden Sherman designs are wildly insane here as they go deeper into the body. The danger is bigger. I really like this book. It's tense. And I know it sounds like I'm being dismissive by comparing it to Annihilation, but I'm doing so favorably.
Yeah, I think that's a positive comparison. That it feels like Alien movies. It feels like Event Horizon, if you remember that movie, which is like super bleak, but following people who are like, we're doing this adventure and we're probably going to die. And that dread is here in basically every panel. But the art's super cool, very well designed book top to bottom. I'm also really enjoying this.
Fantastic Four, number 23 from Marvel, written by Ryan North, art by Carlos Gomez. In this issue, we're getting a new fangled alien invasion. The main character is Johnny Storm, and the title of the book is, I believe, I Got Strangled by an Alien. And the bit here is Johnny Storm telling the story of how he got strangled by an alien. And throughout it, we get this weird science mystery. Man, I know I've said this with every issue, I think, so far, but it really underscored with this issue. I think this is one of the best Fantastic Four runs of all time. I love every issue.
The tone, the feeling is so positive and strong. It's like Ryan North really gets them and puts it in every issue. The last issue was like a sort of a standalone Reed Alicia storyline. Great, and this is like a Johnny Storm focused thing, but everyone gets a little bit of do. There's a lot of great just pure science information that Ryan North weaves into every issue, and it's super interesting and fun. I agree with you. This is a landmark run on Fantastic Four.
Last but not least, Geiger, number five from Image Comics, written by Jeff Johns, art by Gary Frank. Here we have Geiger, our radioactive man, is battling the electrician.
Aren't we all battering electricians, with their overprices for fixing something?
I'm battling the Cable Man, a.k.a. Jim Carrey.
Yeah. The Cable Man, famously known as the Cable Man.
Yep. And Cable Guy, sorry about that. anyway, Geiger is battling him. This is a guy who has figured out how to take away Geiger's radioactive man powers. There's some big stuff that goes down in this issue, specifically some mythological stuff for the overall unknown universe that Jeff Johns is building. Justin, I'm curious to hear from you. I really dug this, but you've been kind of down on Geiger. How'd you feel about this issue?
Well, I like it a lot more now that the story's moving forward rather than just him, a continual check-in on him being like bleakly wandering the apocalyptic landscape, being sad. Though having said that, I will say the addition here is he's sad now specifically about his dog. And even when he meets his dog, he's only a little bit happier. So I do want to have some other tones laid in with our Geiger, our cable Geiger that we are dealing with here. And hopefully the story will start to move in different directions now that it is touching on a much larger world.
We shall see. And if you'd like to support this podcast and all the podcasts we do, patreon.com/comicbookclub. Also, we do a live show every Tuesday night at 7 p.m. to Facebook and YouTube. Coming out, we would love to chat with you about comic books. Apple, Spotify, Android, or the app of your choice to subscribe, listen, and follow the show at Comic Book Live on Twitter/X, Comic Book Club Live on TikTok and Instagram, comicbookclublive.com. For this podcast and many more, until next time, we'll see you at the Comic Book Club.
All right, time for that date makeover we talked about, Alex. Hey. Take off those glasses and you're instantly hotter. Whoa. It worked.
Of the fatal life.